You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
This is Kristen Ferrick for the Art World Demystified, and I'm here with artist Lara Almarcegui, a Spanish artist based in Rotterdam. She's an advocate for overlooked, forgotten sites, creating guides for urban wastelands, and even instigating their legal protection. In 2013, Almarcegui received critical and popular success by representing Spain at the 55th Venice Biennale, where she filled the interior of the pavilion with massive piles of building materials corresponding to those used by workers during its construction. And Lara, thank you so much for being here today. I'd love to start first with asking you about that installation at the Spanish Pavilion. And can you tell me what that was all about?
Hello, good morning. I'm very glad to talk with you today. So the project in Venice consisted on making an installation about the whole Spanish pavilion. That means I had the whole building for myself. That is quite an amazing opportunity because I could really build with the whole totality of the place. And I first made a list of all the construction materials used to build it, counting how much concrete there is, how many bricks were used, how many tiles, how much iron, how much glass. And then we borrow all these materials and we put them inside the pavilion. That means a lot of construction materials, really a lot. We show them in rubble. They were rubble, actually demolition rubble, that we collect from the plant where all the rubble from Venice is storage. So whenever a building is demolished in Venice, by law, they have the demolisher has to bring the rubble to that place where they smash it and create a smaller gravel. So this is the material we got into the Spanish Pavilion. Basically, there was a mountain of over 700 tons of rubble.
Wow.
In the middle of the pavilion. It was quite a large installation, pretty big. I mean, if a building has to contain the rubble equivalent to its construction materials, this is a really big amount of rubble. So there was almost no space for the public. It was very heavy, so we had a problem with the floor. We had to build a new floor to make sure we could carry it. We didn't want the building to collapse, of course. And of course, there is also the suggestion of the demolition of the building, because the amount of rubble was the same as you would have if the building is demolished. In this way, the work could reflect on the past of the building, what is there before a place is constructed, but mainly on the future of a construction, what happened when a place is torn down, what comes out of it, and how is it used, and where does it go. So it was very much a ruin, actually, of the Spanish Pavilion. This was one of the projects, the most spectacular. There was another work that many people didn't even see it because it was very hidden and very small in comparison. That was a research on a wasteland, the larger empty pieces of land in Venice. That was in Murano, one of the islands. And it's a wasteland that was shaped with dredgings from the canals and with leftovers of the Murano industry, which is glass industry, glass production. So basically what we had is a wasteland made of glass, rubble of glass. Very beautiful place, actually. I have been going there very often, and there are these big pieces of glass with different colors, typical of Murano, blue, green, red, yellow pieces. Very, very beautiful place. A huge empty area that is awaiting development. And while bringing a project that explains the story of this place, we were also bringing the question of what is going to happen with the urban situation of Venice in the future. So both were very site-specific works, one about the building of the Spanish Pavilion and the other about Venice.
Right, so that second work had more to do with research and sort of an exploration of an empty space. And so they're still dumping things in on that space.
In a smaller part of it, yes. Mm. Now, first was the whole area was a dump site when it was shaped, and now it's controlled and the dump is just allowed in a certain fence area. They have had a lot of problems with pollution because they were not just dumping leftovers of the glass industry, but also demolition materials.
Right.
Again, and then other more polluting leftovers of different industries. So there have been several scandals, and the police has been there. So now there was more control in the site.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the land was not being used in any way. That's why it was so fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
The project was a lot of about research,
yes,
and it was a very silent work. Really not so spectacular as the mountains, and I thought it was interesting to have two very different projects,
mm-hmm.
one very sculptoric and attractive and the other very secret, but very ambitious as well, because it really talks about the future of Venice.
Yes.
The piece of land is the larger empty piece of land in Venice, so everything that is projected in Venice would have happened there, because mm-hmm. it's really their only large empty piece of land. In Venice they have really crazy projects, as for example the Sublagunare, which it was a plan of making a tunnel that would connect the airport with Venice City. This plan was dropped, but the tunnel would have stopped in this terrain, and nowadays they had a project which is much more just a dream of connecting Murano Island with the continent, with mm-hmm. a bridge, mm-hmm. which would be installed as well in the land. So these are really crazy projects, actually, mm-hmm. that would change the whole territory of Venice.
Huge, yes.
And they create a lot of environmentalist reactions. Luckily they are not being known now. But just to say that this piece of land really reflects what's going on mm-hmm. in the thinking
Big
of
discussion.
Venice.
You've done these installations with building materials inside buildings or next to buildings, and what has been the response from people in places where you do this? I know that you've done it in a number of places around the world, and how do people respond to coming up against or next to being next to huge piles of building materials and rubble and...
Well, these installations with construction materials, the same construction materials used as building a building near the building, have been a bit controversial sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I imagine.
Maybe because, in a way, they are very large,
mm-hmm.
so they are very visible and people really notice them. At the same time, sometimes the press complains because they are not a real sculpture, they are just construction materials. So they get disappointed about what art is or should be.
Yeah.
So they think it's kind of a silly joke, because I don't really do much. It's just a mountain of rubble, a pile up mm-hmm. of materials. So there has been some criticism and a lot of discussion. I think the main discussion comes from the fact that is art in public space, so it is really open for everyone.
Yes.
So it always generates more conversations than the projects inside the galleries.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily enough, that's a good part.
Yes.
But of course, some sensationalist press has been using them as a way to attack art on a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily enough, every time this happened, I got a response of people defending art. So the projects have been controversial, I must say. They have been touching some people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Very often people that know very well the neighborhood or know very well the building where mm-hmm. the projects are referred. They are sometimes particularly touched by the project. Maybe even they get emotional about the mm-hmm. the work, because the work is really talking about the past of the
yes.
building in a way that people that relate to the buildings can get really touched.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the good part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is for sure not my most successful project, so there's a lot of discussion going on. But as I told you last time, I think the good about these discussions is that they are very often not so much about me or the work, but they are about the site, about what
yes.
the city is doing, why they turned down mm. this building, why they didn't renovate, what they are going to do there,
yes.
who is the new owner, why did he bought, why the city sold it. So they generate serious conversation and discussion about the way things are going on with the real estate mm-hmm. and the urban planning of the city, which I think it is a very necessary
yeah.
discussion. This discussion is happening a little bit more often now in Spain, for example, since we have the financial crisis that started with the real estate market, but was not so common before.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the good effect of those
yes.
projects.
So you've been really interested in buildings that are either abandoned or condemned or buildings that are sort of up in the air, and you've also done some performative works, I believe, with around that idea.
Yeah.
What was that about?
Well, I was doing more performances at the start of my practice.
Yeah.
I think I was trying to prove engagement with the site I was working.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about buildings and places and know more about them. But I was very worried to work in a very cold way. Like, I didn't want to be like just a university researcher.
Yeah.
I feel like I really wanted to have a real engagement with the places.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be physically involved with the places I wanted to work with. So in this sense, I start the action of, for example, renovating a market that was scheduled for demolition. I started that project 1 month before the demolition date, and I was there every day on the scaffold renovating the facades of the building. So this is really a physical engagement with a building and with a certain idea of saying this was a good building and
mm-hmm.
it should not be demolished. So I was interested in activism and in generating discussions, but I also wanted to be fully engaged in that. So my physical effort for the renovation was a necessary part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I had to prove it myself. I did another other projects about digging in places to know more about the layers below the ground, to know more about the materials below,
mm-hmm.
to know more about the geology and the earth. And for me, again, it was very important to do it by myself physically
mm-hmm.
to have this engagement.
Mm-hmm. That real connection,
yeah.
Yes. Did this work that you're doing around abandoned and orphaned spaces in the urban environment, did that come out of the work with the buildings and the idea of demolishing buildings, or how did that happen?
I started working with buildings scheduled for demolition and abandoned buildings. Later, doing some more thinking about the city and also living in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
Amsterdam is an extremely well-designed town. I had to have this big longing for non-designed spaces.
Yes.
And then I start to look for empty lots on wastelands. So I think it was a bit the city that brought me to that. And then I start to think why I'm interested in wasteland, so I try to do some more critical thinking on the city, and then realizing this is really my response to this over-designed city situation that we have in Amsterdam, in most European towns. So I think one thing brought me to the other.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that you were drawn to these spaces because you felt that your environment was
yeah.
overly designed.
Yeah.
So then that sort of to me begs the question of, but what is it about those spaces then? I know you've said that it doesn't have anything to do with the environment necessarily, or that you're not necessarily an environmentalist.
Yeah, these places are not an idyllic, never touch nature.
No.
They are not like a mountain nature. They are not a national park or a preserve. But they are in the city. They have some nature, very little and very threatened, but very different than the accepted nature.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm more interested in them as a response to the urban condition
mm-hmm.
and as a response to construction. So basically I could say I want wastelands because there is too many constructions around.
Mm-hmm.
So when I am in the faraway mountains, maybe I don't need wastelands so much. So it's very much a reaction to the construction.
Mm-hmm.
So they really fill up a gap of produced by the need of empty places that are non-designed, thinking that everything is so rational around me, that I need something that has not been so rationalized, basically.
What I love about those empty spaces is it, even though they can often be covered with cement, there's still or you know, leftovers from urban buildings and that sort of thing, they've been affected by nature, by wind, by water, by plants growing up through the cracks and things like that. So there is something random about it that I think I crave, that I don't experience in this very organized environment of the city. So I totally understand your attraction to that. So what do you do around these abandoned spaces? What is it that you how do you work with that, those kind of spaces?
Well, what I like about them is exactly what you mentioned, as this randomness or this idea that everything happens there by chance. Mm. So I try to talk about them and present them as an alternative to the public, but without touching them and without controlling them. And this is very complicated, of course. So I have been doing three different actions on the wastelands. One is to produce guides and maps of them. They are very similar to the architectural guides, where the best wastelands or empty lots of a city are located, and then there are texts explaining what is happening in each one of them. And these guides basically are a tool inviting the public to go and visit them and have their own experience in the place. I like these publications because they really give all the freedom to the reader. It's like, if you have one of my publications on wastelands, you know where they are, and then you're invited to go if you want, or maybe you don't want, or you go the day you like to the ones that are more near your flat. You know, they give you just the possibility. They are a tool. In that sense, I like them a lot. These guides, I have been focusing lately in threatened wastelands, so areas that are under a big pressure, for example, by large development projects. The Olympics are a very typical big, large development project. I think in Toronto you know a lot about it. So the Olympics are really large operations that threaten so many wonderful pieces of land that whenever the Olympics are happening somewhere, I try to go and document them before the land is developed and all this wonderful nature disappears. Another action I have been doing is just to get the gates open. So wherever there is a very interesting empty lot, but it's fenced off, I try to get a permit to open it to the public. And sometimes we have done that during one day or one weekend or one month. It depends. But I think it's always good to make land available. That's a very simple action, but it works well and it's cheap. And then the third action I have been doing and I'm still doing is more complex, and it consists on preserving wastelands to propose to the owner of a large empty lot to keep it undeveloped, so that it stays just open to everything. So it's not that I don't want the area to change. Of course it changes. It can change, affected by random, by the nature or maybe the users, but really it would develop in a spontaneous way. So to make sure there is no design in a certain land. This project, I describe it as stealing away land or terrain to constructors. or designers.
Yes. It's wonderful to see how children really respond to those kind of environments where things are growing free and allowed to be. But on the other hand, I know from working with parks how sometimes people are afraid of that randomness. At the same time, we crave nature, we need to be around nature, but at the same time people have this desire to control it, and there's almost sometimes people object to having parks or natural spaces in their close to where they live, because they think it's going to bring some negative activities along with it.
Mm.
So those kind of spaces really are bring out a lot of conflicting emotions in people. So now, have you been successful to preserve some pieces of abandoned or spaces?
Yes. Well, we fell a lot of times, but we managed to protect some. So there are two that are protected for a limited amount of time. One in Rotterdam Port for 15 years, and one in Belgium for 12 years. But we are going to work on the master plan to have it forever. And then there are two that are protected permanently, one in Taipei in Taiwan and one in Zaragoza, in my hometown. So those two are very successfully well protected. Yeah, I'm very glad about them. And now we're negotiating a new one.
And this is a different kind of protection than what people often consider protection of natural spaces, because oftentimes it's protected for viewing but not for just being how it evolves. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, the protection leaves the site much more open than what you would have in another place, like in a nature preserve. All these regulations.
Yes.
Almost scary. So I'm not busy doing that. Of course, there is a law going on. That's the main law you have everywhere in society. But I don't create particular rules of how the space has to be used.
Yes.
Which maybe brings back the subject of what you were mentioning, of the fear. I mean, there is some fear, but it's a completely mental thing. There's the fear of the non-control or the non-design or non-regulated. But it's really mental construction.
Mm.
Actually, there's this botanist in Rotterdam, Remco Aardewegh, who works with wild plants, and he really supports me. We support each other because he can really give very interesting narratives to why wastelands are important in the city, because there are these wild plants, these foreigner plants, that these weeds, that they are not allowed anywhere else in the city. They don't supposed to be there in the gardens or in the parks. They don't supposed to be in the natural areas because they are bad for the nature. They're not autochthon. And he defends them, and for him, the wastelands give the space to these plants. So we really help each other.
Those kind of limits have more to do with farming and not wanting certain plants to encroach on farming.
Of course.
But in the city, that's not really relevant, and we actually people are realizing that we need those kind of wild plants and for our health so I think people are starting to come around with those ideas.
Yeah. Well, it is very interesting. I mean, it is already ridiculous, the idea that certain plants have more right to exist than others, and it's completely ridiculous. So whether we need them or not, they should also, they have also the right to exist, I guess. So anyway, Remco was telling me this idea that actually the houses are more dangerous than the wastelands. For a woman, if you see the statistics of violence, there are quite a lot of there's quite a lot of violence going on
with inside enclosed spaces. True enough.
Yeah, the domestic space can be very dangerous for women in Europe. I don't know here, but very much. It's in Spain for sure, in the Netherlands, in Denmark. So their representation that wastelands are dangerous is completely, it's really in our minds, because they are not that dangerous.
Yeah, true enough. So what have you got going on now? What are you planning for? I'm sure these projects take a long time to plan and get off the ground, because both the projects that involve buildings and the projects that involve spaces require a lot of negotiation, I imagine.
Yeah.
How long would it take to develop and see a project through?
Well, it depends very much. There was this land we protected in Belgium in 2004. Lately, the last 2 years ago, I managed to enlarge the protection for 2 more years. That's not long. Another promised me to be in the master plan. So there are things that are going on. And then there's also this other land in Eindhoven, in Holland, we start negotiating the protection last August. Now I need to get the contract this summer. So there are always different levels of negotiations mm-hmm. going on. They really can last for years.
Mm-hmm. And how does that get tied to art, to different art festivals?
Well, it depends. Sometimes the project in Belgium was started with a very small art center, a local art center called FLAC. But then later, Manifesta, which is the European Art Biennale that happened in a different city, mm-hmm. so the next one is happening in St. Petersburg. It happened in Genk, in Belgium, in the city where I had the Wasteland. So when the curator invited me to be part of the show and sent a new proposal, I told him, well, the first we should do is to rescue the Wasteland and enlarge the protection, because 10 years are wonderful, but we want more. Mm-hmm. So it was thanks to the Biennial that we are negotiating now to be part of the master plan and have it forever. So sometimes there are very big biennials behind mm-hmm. the project. Sometimes the projects are started with a local art center. The project in Eindhoven is started by the Van Aben Museum, that's a museum of the city. So I'm very open to work mm-hmm. with different institutions or artist-run spaces. They all can be very good. Mm-hmm. So it depends on whom I'm working with. And normally I find people that are very engaged in the project.
Yes, yeah, because they're right on the ground and yeah. relating to their environment and understand all these ideas around design and art and process.
Yeah, I mean, and those are adventures. When we started, I tried to warn the people working with me, make sure that you know that this might be not accomplished in years. So
yes.
It's really an adventure together. Yeah.
Right. And so in the upcoming, do you...
Yes, so I have other projects a bit different now in Norway. We have to present at the end of May a new work where I was invited to work relating with the activities of the Ministry of Environment, so I could do thinking about what's going on with the territory in Norway. So I was thinking, what are the bigger changes in land, which is mining, basically. So I visit many different mining areas, mm-hmm. areas where they are planning to open new mines, but they are not open yet, so they are awaiting for this big thing to happen that will bring a lot of money mm-hmm. to the city and a lot of labor, at the same time would destroy the nature. Mm-hmm. So I was very impressed by this moment of expectation and
yes.
the moment of the destruction as well. I thought was quite interesting. So I wanted to do a project that reflect on that, and then I realized that actually Norway has an island in the Arctic called Spitsbergen. Mm-hmm. It's part of Svalbard Archipelago, and that's really in the Arctic, really, really north. And there's a lot of mining going on, and they plan new mining in a wonderful glacier. So I thought it was very good to work with it as a way to discuss all these territorial mm-hmm. changes. Mm-hmm. And what we have been doing is to calculate the weight of the whole island and identify the different rocks. So basically we made a calculation of the rocks that configure the island, how mm-hmm. much granite, how much marble, how much basalt, mm-hmm. how much volcanic rocks, as a way to present the rock formations mm-hmm. and the minerals and how they are threatened by the future. Mm-hmm. So this has been a very large project. I've been working with geologists mm-hmm. and we are about to present it very soon.
So where would that be presented?
We will present. We made the publication with all the process of the
right.
calculation, which is quite interesting, and long, complicated process. And then we will write a list of all the rocks in a building from the Ministry of Environment, which is in Trondheim, in the middle of Norway.
In the middle of Norway.
Yeah.
Right.
I can tell you as anecdote that the first person I contact from the mapping section, I contacted people that produce the maps, the geological maps, mm-hmm. the Polar Institute, to make sure they help us and they help us finding the right way to make the calculations. They first initially told me that actually I shouldn't do such a project because it is impossible.
Oh!
Yeah, it was quite interesting email. Basically what they say is that there are areas they still have not explored because they are below the ice and they cannot access, so there are areas where they just don't know what is there.
Right.
So they thought it's impossible to do such a calculation. I was a bit blocked when I got this news, yes. And then I later convinced them that actually artists, we find that very interesting, that the work is also questioning how accurate can be such a calculation and questioning itself.
Yes.
So that actually such a calculation can be done if we acknowledge our own limits.
Mm-hmm.
That's how artists work. So.
Yes.
And actually there's a big amount of unknown rocks in the calculation.
right, of course. So I think it's really great to be bringing to the forefront the idea of some of these mining and industrial industrial activities that are happening in very remote territories. That's where in here in Canada we have some big industrial polluting activities going on, but because it's so far away, people don't really connect it to themselves. For an artist to think about things in a different way, it's I think it's really, really great.
I normally like to work with what is there, where we are, really. Like if we are in Paris, talk about Paris.
Mm-hmm.
If we are in Toronto, talk about Toronto. I first found a bit complicated to work with an island so far away.
Mm-hmm.
But every time I was thinking about mining, I realized this is really the place, because the scale of the mining is huge, but also because it is very meaningful for the future. It's a geopolitics discussion. And actually, it is the whole thing is not about that island. It's about mining the Arctic. It's about the presence. It's a geopolitical discussion about the right to continue further mining. In fact, that island has a lot of areas that are protected. There are many national parks, so it is not in such a big risk. But talking about it, it's a way to talk about what's going on in the north, which I guess in Canada you know very well as well.
Yes, very important. Very important discussion, how things are evolving and up north. I would like to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and the rest of the art world that listens to the show, and good luck with all your future projects.
Thank you. A pleasure to talk with you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.